This is lecture number 9 on Isaiah, chapters 40 to 56, by Alan McCrae of Biblical Theological Seminary. Lecture number 9. Your assignment for next time is to take a look at Isaiah 53, specifically verses 4, 5, 8, and 9, and to compare them in the King James Version to any other modern version and note any significant differences. Now, we were looking last time at the section of Isaiah that included chapter 50. We notice in chapter 50, the first three verses really belong with the previous chapter. They are another stanza of the same discussion as found in the previous chapter. And you really should start a new chapter with verse 4. With verse 4, we have statements made that would be difficult to explain if we had not already, in chapter 49, had the servant of the Lord speaking and telling how the Lord was going to use him to raise up the tribes of Jacob and also to bring light to all the nations. Thus, having had the servant of the Lord speaking so recently, it is a viable option to see whether he might be speaking in verses 4 and following. We notice there that there are statements made that would hardly fit Israel. It wouldn't seem likely that Israel would say, quote, "The sovereign Lord has opened my ears, and I have not been rebellious. I have not drawn back," end quote. This is verse 5. Because Israel has been criticized by Isaiah in previous chapters for being rebellious. And then going on, we read, quote, "I did not hide my face from mocking and spitting," end quote. This is verse 6. Well, that certainly doesn't sound like Israel talking. It doesn't sound like Isaiah talking either. Isaiah may have, perhaps, in the last part of his life, suffered some persecution, but we certainly have no evidence of his having ever voluntarily submitted to humiliation as described here. Of course, it is not God that's speaking here, because we read, quote, "The sovereign Lord has given me this, the sovereign Lord has given me that," end quote. And so the best option remains that it is the servant that is speaking these verses. We have learned quite a bit about the servant of the Lord in previous chapters. Now, beginning in verse 4, we read, "The sovereign Lord has given me," end quote. And the NIV says, quote, "an instructed tongue," end quote. The King James says that the Lord has given him, quote, "the tongue of the learned," end quote. The trouble with that in present-day English is that the term learned suggests a scholar or somebody like that. If you take the word learned in its literal sense, it fits exactly as a good translation, but it doesn't give quite the idea that people will understand today. As I said, we think of a learned person as possibly having received a doctor's degree and doing great research when we say, quote, "the tongue of the learned," end quote. But the translation, "the tongue of one who has been instructed," is not correct either. The "one" has the plural form in Hebrew. The King James, in this case, conveys that idea well, because in modern English we do not use an adjective as a noun except for a plural. We say, quote, "between the quick and the dead," end quote. We don't mean one person and then another person. We mean the plural. Quick and the dead are considered to be together. In most languages, you can use it for singular or plural, but in modern English, only for the plural. Here, it is plural, so the translation, quote, "an instructed tongue," end quote, is not very literal in the NIV. Literally, it should be, quote, "the tongue of those who have been instructed," end quote. That's where the plural comes in, but perhaps there is not much difference in the sense after all. In Old English, you could use it for singular as you can in most languages. So where we read in Isaiah 11 that, quote, "he shall smite the wicked," end quote, and we read in 2 Thessalonians that, quote, "then shall the one be revealed, that wicked whom the Lord will strike with the breath of his lips," and so on, that wicked should be the wicked one. It is singular. But in Old English, you could use the term for singular or plural. So here the Lord is giving him, the servant, a tongue that is, quote, "like the tongues of those who are instructed," end quote. You remember people, what they said about Jesus, They said, "How does this man know so much, having never been schooled?" Well, he knew everything, and he showed a knowledge far beyond what they had expected him to have. So, quote, "To know the word that sustains the weary, he wakes me every morning, morning by morning, he wakens my ear to listen like one being taught," end quote. This is verse 4. And the Gospels show us how Jesus lived in constant communication with his Father. There is a great stress there in the New Testament on the relationship between the Father and the Son. This might be said of Isaiah, but the whole context wouldn't really fit Isaiah. But it does look forward to Christ very definitely, what he will do and what he can do. Quote, "The sovereign Lord has opened my ears, and I've not been rebellious. I have not drawn back. I offered my back to those who beat me, my cheeks to those who pulled off the beard. I did not hide my face from mocking and spitting," end quote. And this we read in verse 6. The New Testament tells us how Jesus voluntarily suffered. He said, "I lay down my life. No one takes it from me." He said to Pilate that he could do nothing if it were not given to him by above. He had all power, but he chose not to use it. So we read again, verse 7, quote, "Because the sovereign Lord helps me, I will not be disgraced. Therefore, I have set my faith like flint," end quote. Everybody said to Jesus, "Don't walk back to Jerusalem. You'll get killed. You'll be injured." We read in the New Testament that he set his face to go to Jerusalem. So, quoting again from Isaiah, verses 7 to 9, we have, "And I know that I will not be put to shame. He who vindicates me is near. Who then will bring charges against me? Let us face each other. Who is my accuser? Let him confront me. It is the sovereign Lord who helps me. Who is he that will condemn me? They will all wear out like a garment. The moths will eat them up," end quote. Very interesting how he compares his endless light to the light of the people who were attacking him and persecuting him. It says that they will wear out, the moths will eat them up, but he, the servant, will live forever. Then in chapter 50, verses 10 and 11, the servant addresses the people in general. He says, quote, "Who among you fears the Lord and obeys the word of his servant? Let him who walks in the dark, who has no light, trust in the name of the Lord and rely on his God," end quote. This is describing the life of the Christian who does not know what is ahead. He doesn't know what God's plan is for him. He is, to some extent, walking in the dark. He should use all the light he can get, but still, he's walking in the dark. We don't know what's ahead for any one of us, but we can trust in the name of the Lord and know that if we are truly his, we can rely on him to give us his light. But in chapter 50, verse 11, he turns back to those who do not trust in the Lord, who do not look to the word of God for their wisdom. He says, quote, "But now all you who light fires and provide yourselves with flaming torches," end quote. That is, you who think that by human wisdom you are going to find the answers to all your problems. You who think you can direct your life in the way that you should go. You who think you can figure everything out on a human basis only. He says, "You light fires and provide yourselves with flaming torches." So he then says, "Go, walk in the light of your fires and of the torches you have set ablaze. But this is what you will receive from my hand. You will lie down in torment," end quote. Of course, God wants us to use all the light we can get. He gave us our brains to use, but we don't know what's ahead. But we can put all that we can learn by purely human means in a secondary place in relation to the Word of God, which should be the primary source of our knowledge. And so he says, those who trust only in their own wisdom, that they will lie down in torment. Then in chapter 51, we start a long poem of reassurance. This long poem of reassurance is, to a large extent, addressed to Israel, thought of as inevitably going into exile and written in such a way as to comfort the Israelites in exile, but at the same time recognizing some of the development of thought in the previous chapters. That, after all, the reason that they are going to exile is because of their sin. If God delivers them from exile and does not deal with the sin question, there will be other exiles inevitably. But in this passage, the question of sin is only touched on a little. There is hardly any rebuke in this section. It is more assurance. Assurance that they can trust in the Lord is going to fulfill His promise. He's going to bring them back from exile, and the suggestion, not strongly emphasized in this section, that He is also going to deal with the sin question, which is, after all, the cause of the exile, as He has been gradually developing the thought from chapter 41 on. Chapter 40, you will recall, was a prelude to the whole section, touching upon the general themes that we find throughout the section. We have, to some extent, a reminiscence of this section of chapter 40 as we touch on certain of its main ideas. So, he says in chapter 51, verses 1 and 2, "Look to me, you who pursue righteousness, and seek the Lord. Look to the rock from which you were cut, and the quarry from which you were hewn. Look to Abraham, your father, and to Sarah, who gave you birth. When I called him, he was but one, and I blessed him and made him many." End quote. God has given great blessings to Abraham. Look back at what he's done. Now, don't despair and say, "God won't give anything to me." You can trust him. Isaiah continues through this section with reasons for assurance for the people to trust in God. But in chapter 51, verses 4 and 5, he goes way beyond the immediate situation and promises that he is going to do the same in the future. In verse 4, we read, "Listen to me, the law will go out from me, my justice will become a light to the nations. My righteousness draws near speedily, my salvation is on the way, and my arm will bring justice to the nations. The islands will look to me and wait in hope for my arm. Lift up your eyes to the heavens, look at the earth beneath. The heavens will vanish like smoke, the earth will wear out like a garment, and its inhabitants die like flies. But my salvation will last forever, my righteousness will never fail." End quote. And so he continues with these assurances of continued God's blessing. In chapter 51, verse 9, he says, quote, "Awake, awake, clothe yourselves with strength, O arm of the Lord. Awake, as in the days gone by, as in generations of old. Was it not you who cut Rahab to pieces?" End quote. Well, these nations around Israel observed human sacrifice, but God never commanded it to Israel. So why would somebody say that it was the arm of the Lord that cut Rahab to pieces? Well, here we have a strange thing, that the very same word that was the name of Rahab, the woman who was blessed for helping the Israelite spies as they came into the land of Canaan, that exact word is a common term occasionally used in the scripture with the idea of a monster. It often is used specifically for Egypt, because of the way that Egypt held the Israelites in bondage and the way that God brought them out. There are two or three instances out of the very few times that this word occurs this way. As I say, there are two or three instances where it definitely means a monster, and two or three where it definitely means Egypt, and one or two where we're not quite sure which is meant. But here he refers undoubtedly to Egypt as the one pierced, the monster who is pierced, because the next verse states, quote, "Was it not you who dried up the sea, the waters of the great deep, who made a road in the depths of the sea so that the redeemed might cross over?" End quote. Here Isaiah is looking back to the deliverance through the Red Sea as he delivered Israel from Egypt. He says, "The arm of the Lord has done this. We can expect him still to give us deliverance. We can trust him even as he delivered the Israelites out of Egypt." Then in chapter 51, verses 12 to 16, we have perhaps the last great stress on the idea of God's creative power in this section. Remember how that's been stressed in chapter after chapter previously. Between Isaiah 40 and here, we have more stress on God's creative power than probably in any other section of the Bible except the book of Job. There is this tremendous stress on God's creative power because it is dealing with his power to rescue the people from exile and his power to deal with the cause of the exile, to deal with the problem of sin. So there is here the last great stress on this chapter in chapter 51, verse 13 and following of God's power. It states, "That you forget he is the Lord your Maker, who stretched out the heavens and laid the foundations of the earth." End quote. Astronomers today are agreed that the heavens indeed are stretched out. Here's what we mean. 50 years ago, there were many of the astronomers who doubted that the heavens were at all stretched. Perhaps even 20 years ago, many thought that the heavens had always been exactly as they are now. The universe was static. There was no beginning and there was no end. But today, all astronomers agree that all the universe was at one time a small ball of matter, that this small ball of matter had a tremendous explosion, and that after this tremendous explosion, all the stars and the galaxies that form have been moving rapidly away from one another. This is what we mean by stretched out. Nobody knows what caused them to do this. Some astronomers have tried to say that the universe has always been here, but it's just been continuously expanding and contracting, that is, getting larger and getting smaller. Over time, all this matter will stop going out and gravity will take over and it will all come together again, and we will again have a great ball of matter, or a small ball with all the matter of the universe together, and again it will explode. This continuous expansion and contraction is what was known as the oscillating universe. But most astronomers would say there is no reason that the universe is going to collapse upon itself, and if there's no reason to think that it's going to collapse in the future, there's no reason to ever think it collapsed in the past. All the evidence today that science has points to the whole universe as having started at one time and then going out with a tremendous motion in all directions, and this fits exactly with what is said here. Quote, "The Lord, your Maker, who stretched out the heavens," end quote, not who simply made them as they are, but who stretched them out. Isaiah could have said it was the Lord who created the universe, but he doesn't. It says it is the Lord who stretched out the universe, stretched out the heavens. It's an interesting thing that this phrase, "stretched out the heavens," is used a few times of the Lord in the prophetic books. There are also a few times that instead of using the perfect tense that the Lord stretched out the heavens, such as you have here, it uses the participle with the sense of it's the Lord who, quote, is stretching out the heavens, end quote. And why should such an idea ever have occurred that he is stretching out the heavens? He simply did not do something once, but is doing it. It's a continuous action to say that the Lord is stretching out the heavens, rather than he stretched out the heavens. Well, as I've said before, anybody up until 50 years ago would have said, of course, that's just a formal expression. Sometimes you say stretched out, and sometimes you say is stretching out. But we know now for the last 50 years, I don't know whether we should use the word know for anything that we do not have the evidence of Scripture for, but I will say that as far as all scientists believe today, they all believe that the whole universe is, quote, being stretched out, end quote. That is, all parts of the universe are moving away from all other parts at a rapid rate as the result of the discovery made in the first decade of the 20th century, which all astronomers now agree shows that this is the situation. Now, if that is true, we have here a very interesting use of this participle, stretching out, suggesting the idea that this could not have been constructed from science that people knew at the time the Bible was written, but that there is a suggestion there which, when we make the discovery, we find that the Scripture says exactly what the discovery is showing us. Now, I've never heard that pointed out by anybody else, but I was struck by the difference in the verbal form in the Hebrew, that is, between stretched out or stretching out. And then, when I came across this knowledge that this is so generally believed by astronomers, it just struck me as very interesting that there was already a suggestion of this here in the Scriptures. So Isaiah refers to the Lord's great power that here in this verse is the beginning of it. Now, specific emphasis on the continuation of that power is that he stretched out the heavens and laid the foundations of the earth. Isaiah continues with the words of assurance to Israel with the emphasis on the way he is to deal with her problems. But not only that, he's going to deal with the cause of these problems. So here there is a considerable amount of mention of their suffering and their sad condition. There's no rebuke, really, however, here. In earlier chapters, we had very strong rebuke, although nothing like other parts of the prophetic literature. From chapters 40 on, the theme is mostly comfort and just an occasional reference to the fact that the cause of all their problem is their sin. But it is mostly comfort because they are thought of as those who primarily need comfort here rather than rebuke. But there is an occasional slight rebuke to bring to their attention the cause of the suffering that they are going through. Chapter 52 is a clear continuation of what preceded. We've had these very sections starting with the phrase, "Awake, awake," and then going on. Chapter 52 begins with the same phrase, "Awake, awake, O Zion, clothe yourself with strength, put on your garments of splendor." He continues with his promises of blessing to the people and of deliverance from the exile. In verse 7 and following, we have a very strong echo of chapter 40. To quote from chapter 40, "How beautiful on the mountains are the feet of those who bring good news," end quote. Remember, in chapter 40, we also have, "O Jerusalem, get you up to a high mountain. O Zion, bring assurance of blessing to God's people." We also read, "How beautiful on the mountains are the feet of those who bring good news, who proclaim peace, who say to Zion, your God reigns." This fits with the deliverance from exile, but as we saw before, it also fits with deliverance with the problem of sin. Both are being dealt with throughout the section. So we read, quote, "Listen, you who lift up your voice together. They shout for joy when the Lord returns to Zion. They will see it with their own eyes," end quote. Then verse 11 is very definitely getting back to the idea of the deliverance from exile. We read in chapter 52 of verse 11, "Depart, depart, go out from thence, touch no unclean thing. Come out from it and be pure, you who carry the vessels of the Lord." You remember that when Cyrus gave the decree for many people to go back from exile, he ordered that the vessels of the temple, or as we said before, the utensils that were used in the temple, which had been taken by Nebuchadnezzar when Jerusalem was conquered, which were in Babylon, that they be given to the Israelites to take back with them to the new temple that they were going to build in Jerusalem. So we read, "You who carry the vessels of the Lord, but you will not leave in haste or in flight, for the Lord will go before you. The God of Israel will be your rear guard." And this is verse 11 and 12 in chapter 52. You think of the Israelites in captivity, far away from their homeland, and they might conceivably manage in a time of revolution or difficulty in the Babylonian government to escape and flee back in danger, but that is not what God says is going to happen. Look at what he says. "You will not go by flight." That is, you won't have to leave in fear. God is sending Cyrus, who will issue a decree for permitting the Israelites to go back. That is, to all those who desire to go back, and he's going to give them help by giving them the vessels to go back and rebuild the temple in Jerusalem. Now, in chapter 52, verse 11, we have the following. "Depart, depart, go out from there. Touch no unclean thing. Come out and be pure, you who carry the vessels of the Lord. But you will not leave in haste or go in flight, for the Lord will go with you. The God of Israel will be your rear guard." This is where there should be a new chapter division, in my opinion. And it is truly unfortunate that the English archbishop that we've mentioned before, who in the 12th century made the chapter divisions when he was riding on his horse making pastoral calls, well, he made the chapter divisions in the Latin Bible, and these were later taken over into the Hebrew Bible. Well, instead of putting the chapter division here where it belongs, he put it three verses later. It breaks up the thought, and the result is that you will find commentaries discussing Isaiah 53, who will begin with the first verse of chapter 3, with the phrase, "Who has believed our message, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed?" End quote. Well, who's talking, they say? Who's talking? Why, it is evidently the great voice of the succession of the prophets who has believed the message. The King James says, who has believed our report? Personally, I don't think that either report or message is a good translation here. I think the American Standard Version is a much better translation, and I'm not speaking of the Revised Standard Version, I'm speaking of the American Standard Version that came out in 1901, which has here, quote, who has believed what we have heard, end quote. Now, the verbal form here is definitely a passive participle. Quote, who has believed what we have heard, end quote. Now, that phrase, what we have heard, is a message, of course. What if it was talking about who has believed what we have given out? Why, you would expect it to use a different form than the passive participle. Of course, it does carry over the idea that not everybody is going to believe the message, and so we have in the New Testament, very properly, that it uses this phrase in this sense, that not everyone is going to believe the message of Christ, and that is a factor in interpreting the verse here, but not the primary thought of the verse in the Hebrew. The verse here is saying, who has believed what we have heard? And so all this discussion and commentaries would be quite needless, quite unnecessary, if they had only noted this, that the chapter really begins 3 verses earlier. That is, the material in Isaiah 53 really begins with verse 13 of chapter 52. That is, this theme, this subject, begins 3 verses earlier, and there should not be a break at this place where the break is made. I think we lose a great deal of value of Isaiah 53 when we omit the first 3 verses just before. I've known many people who have memorized the whole of Isaiah 53, but I've never met anyone who has memorized from Isaiah 52 verse 13 on through chapter 53, and I don't think you really get the sense of Isaiah 53 without the last 3 verses of chapter 52. The fact is, there is a lot of tremendous truth here. The picture of how God is going to deal with sin and the picture of how the servant of the Lord is going to do his great work is in this chapter. But you don't really get the proper introduction to 53 or the proper understanding of this chapter when you leave out the previous 3 verses, which I feel are so important in the interpretation of chapter 53. And so chapter 53, at the risk of being boring, I'll say this again, chapter 53 should begin with chapter 52, verse 13, where he has finished his long poem of reassurance, and where he begins again with the theme of the servant of the Lord, a theme that we have seen at several instances between chapter 41 and here, where the Lord has introduced it, presented the theme of the servant of the Lord, who is Israel, as God's servant. God brought Israel into the world in order that a certain work be done. Not all of Israel can do this work. Some of them are definitely hostile to God. They certainly can't be part of the service. It must be part of Israel. Israel has the responsibility for the work being done, yet the servant who is to do the work, who is part of Israel, who can represent Israel, who can do the work for Israel as well as for the rest of the world, is an individual. And so now we find out how the servant is going to do his work. This is the great climax of the book of Isaiah. It's one of the great climaxes of the entire Old Testament, that is, chapter 53 of Isaiah, but beginning with chapter 52, verse 13. So it begins with a line that is impossible to translate exactly into English. We notice it begins as follows. See, my servant will act wisely. That's what we have in the NIV. But there is a footnote in the NIV that says that my servant will act wisely can also be translated or will prosper. And here we have a Hebrew word which has a specific meaning for which I know of no English word that covers that same meaning. It means that he will do what is effective and that he will do what will be successful. So the translation, he will act wisely, is entirely true. And the translation, he will prosper, as rightly understood, is also entirely true. But it does not mean to prosper simply through chance or good fortune or because things turn out your way. It means to do that which accomplishes the result desired. So really, to act wisely and as a consequence succeed in what he is undertaking is what the Hebrew word means. You find even between two languages as similar as English and German, it is extremely difficult to make a good translation because words don't exactly mesh. An English word will have certain meanings that a particular German word won't carry, and a German word will have certain meanings that one English word won't carry. If you translate word for word, it often doesn't get the sense across. If that is true between English and German, which are languages that are fairly close, how much more will the differences be with languages that are so different as English and Hebrew? But we can find out by studying how a word is used in context exactly, we can find out what it means. That is why I believe the most useful thing for study of the Bible is Young's Analytical Concordance. I don't believe that there is any commentary that is worth half as much to the person who wants to find out what the Bible means as Young's Analytical Concordance. And that is because you find every way that a particular Hebrew or Greek word is translated in Young's Analytical Concordance. So, when you look in Young's under the English word, they have put there together all the Hebrew or Greek words that have that English translation. So it may take you a little time to find the different cases and how the word is used, and sometimes you'll find a Hebrew word translated 10 times one way in English and maybe 200 times another way. When you do, you want to see whether they have made proper translations in the 10 times in English, or whether perhaps that gives you an idea of a certain phase of the meaning that you wouldn't immediately have gotten because you had only seen it translated by one way. 100 years ago, it was widely thought that by etymology, you could tell what a word meant. That doesn't tell you what a word means. Etymology gives suggestion as to what it might mean. But let me give you an example. You can take an old Germanic word from which the German word connect and the English word knight are derived. Knecht in German is a servant, and knight in English is a mark of respect. But the word, as originally was used, was sort of in between. The German Knecht is the one the king looked down at. And so today, in German, it simply has come to mean servant. But in English, the knight indeed was one whom the king looked down on, but the people, who saw him up on his horse, riding with his armor, they looked up to him. And so we have two words derived from the same original, which, you might say, have opposite meanings currently. But we can see how they develop from the same original meaning. And sometimes when words develop like that, you will have two very different meanings in English, but you can trace back how they came from one original root. While in other cases, as in Rahab, which I mentioned a few minutes ago in Hebrew, it's the identical word, but Rahab can mean Egypt, it can mean a monster, or it can mean the woman who helped the spies come into Canaan. Let me give you another example. Take the English word light, L-I-G-H-T. I can hold something up and hold up my little black book here, and I can say that this first thing is lighter than the black book. On the other hand, I can hold a big heavy book and a little book here and say that one is lighter than the other. That's because our word light can mean light in color, or it can mean less heavy. Here are two utterly different meanings of the same word, but they are all spelled L-I-G-H-T. They are utterly different in their meanings, and they are not derived from one another, even though today they are spelled the same way. So this word, quote, he will act wisely, end quote, means that he will act in such a way as to accomplish his purpose. Then we have his exaltation. He will be raised and lifted up and highly exalted. The servant is going to be highly exalted. That's a tremendous thing to say. He is highly exalted, and we've got that in Isaiah 42. We've got it earlier, but we also have his humiliation in chapter 50 and, to some extent, in chapter 49. And our very next verse describes the servant's humiliation. I'm quoting, "Just as there were many who were appalled at him," parenthetical remark, it can also say as many who were appalled at you, but more on this below. End of parenthetical remark. His appearance was so disfigured beyond that of any man, and his form marred beyond human likeness. End quote. His exaltation is immediately followed by his humiliation. This is a strange combination that never would have occurred to a man simply making something up. But God revealed this in giving a prediction, a tremendous prediction of the work of Christ. He's going to be highly exalted, and he is going to succeed in what he undertakes, but he is also going to undergo great humiliation. Well, now, I'm glad the NIV says, quote, just as there were many who were appalled at him, end quote. The word appalled is often translated in such a way as to convey the idea of many who were surprised at him. But the Hebrew word does not mean surprised. It's more like shocked. Appalled is a very good way to render this word into English. The other, shocked, gives quite a false idea. The NIV says, just as there were many who were appalled at him, and that is correct. But then it has a footnote which says, the Hebrew, you, after the him. Well, what are we trying to do in this translation? And here's what it's referring to. Do we translate the verse, just as there were many who were appalled at him, or do we translate it, just as there were many who were appalled at you? And here the NIV says that both are possible. Well, what are we trying to do in a translation? Are we trying to tell you what the translators think, or are we trying to show you what the Hebrew says? There is no other source that I know of, except in those very few cases where a mistake has come in copying the Hebrew. The Greek Septuagint, the very early translation of the Hebrew into Greek, preserves the correct reading. There are a few such cases, but not many. Ordinarily, the Hebrew text can be depended on. And so here, the Hebrew says, there are many who will be appalled at you. And if the Hebrew says you, let's keep it at you and not say many who were appalled at him. So we will say, just as many were appalled at you. If that's the case, who is the you? Well, all through the chapter before, we've been talking about Israel. We read, awake, awake, O Zion, put on your garments of splendor, O captive daughter of Zion. You were sold for nothing, without money you will be redeemed. End quote. We've been talking about Israel before. Now it is a very appalled at you. He is also talking about Israel, especially since he has been talking about the servant in the third person, and now switches to the second. And there's another thing that the NIV translators did not bring out in the translation, but neither does the King James. Verse 14 in the Hebrew begins, just as, which is a good translation. But the next part here is, his appearance was so disfigured. In other words, just as his appearance was so disfigured. I want to concentrate on the so of the phrase, his appearance was so disfigured. The so is the beginning of a phrase in Hebrew. The same Hebrew word, ken, can mean just as, or like this, or so. So we might say, like this you have been appalled. Like this he is going to be humiliated. It is a definite comparison or showing of a result. The word shows close relationship, and we have three statements given, all of which begin with this Hebrew word, ken, which again can mean just as, like this, or so. So we read, just as many were appalled at you. Many people have said, look at Israel, a great nation with great power there, the kingdom of David and Solomon. Look at the long history of Israel, and now you can hardly take Israel as a nation. It is a part of the Babylonian Empire. The people are often exiled there, in suffering and humiliation. It doesn't even seem like a nation anymore. Well, just as many as were appalled at you, that is, at you, Israel, so his, the servant's appearance, is disfigured beyond that of any man. His form is marred beyond human likeness. So here we have a comparison to Israel. They there are recognized that the you is referring to Israel. You could say, just as many as were appalled at you, my people, although there is no my people expressed here, but the you is all through the chapter before, and the servant is here spoken of in the third person, And so it is the natural interpretation that it is his people he's speaking of. They are the you that people are appalled at. So the NIV added the footnote in order to show that they thought the you is meant, which is, I think, much better than changing it to him like most modern translations do. Just as Israel seemed not to be a nation, disfigured, we might say, as an entity, so his appearance was so disfigured beyond that of any man, and his form marred beyond human likeness. Chapter 52, verse 14. Then the next line, which should be the end of the verse, we encounter the word so again. So marred was he, so shall he sprinkle many nations. There should be a paragraph break at the end of that line. Just as many were astonished, were appalled at you, so is he to seem hardly a human for what he suffered, with the scourging, with the crown of thorns, with the terrible suffering of the crucifixion, he will hardly seem human. Such is what he's going to go through. His humiliation is compared to the sufferings of Israel in exile. Then we have his exaltation. We have his humiliation, and then that is followed by his accomplishments. And we read, quote, so shall he sprinkle many nations, end quote. Now, the translators of the Greek Septuagint didn't get any sense out of that. That is the phrase, so shall he sprinkle many nations. So we have a footnote here that says, Hebrew, Septuagint, so will many nations marvel at him, so they will marvel at him, end quote. That is to say, the footnote says that the Hebrew says he will sprinkle many nations, but the Septuagint says that many nations will marvel at him. But that's not what the Hebrew says. The Hebrew says, so shall he sprinkle many nations. It's quite clear. Now, the Revised Standard Version says, if I recall correctly, so shall he startle many nations. And they have a footnote which says, the Hebrew here is obscure. This footnote in the RSV is hogwash, because this Hebrew word occurs about 22 times in the Old Testament, and in about 20 of them, the RSV itself translates it as sprinkle. In one of them, they translated it spatter, and then, in this one case, in Isaiah, they say that the Hebrew is obscure. And, of course, the reason is because the translators of the RSV, just like the translators of the Septuagint, could not get any sense out of saying, so shall he sprinkle many nations. But the word is the word that is commonly used many, many times in the Pentateuch to express the sprinkling with blood of the instruments in the temple in order to purify them. It is the common word for the sacrifices and the purification in the temple. It is a word whose meaning is perfectly plain that way. The only time I think of when it doesn't mean that is when they threw Jezebel out of the window and she was broken when she hit the ground and her blood spattered against the wall. The word definitely means, so shall he sprinkle, but they couldn't get any sense out of it. I can't blame the translators of the Septuagint for not getting any sense out of it. The Jews in those days did not understand what it meant. If they just translated what was there instead of making a guess and said, so shall many nations be startled, many nations marvel at him, it would have been much better. But what's the excuse of the RSV? Peter knew what it meant. And so let's look at what Peter said. We look at 1 Peter and we read here in verse 1, quote, Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ, of God's elect, strangers in the world, scattered through Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia. End quote. Well now, how would you express many nations better than that? Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia. Now, what about these many nations? He says, quote, you have been chosen according to the foreknowledge of God the Father by the sanctifying work of the Spirit for obedience in Christ Jesus and, key point here, sprinkling by his blood, end quote. This is the second verse in 1 Peter 1. So Peter says, I know what it means that he shall sprinkle many nations. That is what Jesus Christ has done by bearing their sins upon the cross and making it possible to purify them from their sins and making this available not just to the Jews, but to many nations, being a light even for the Gentiles. That should be the end of one paragraph, and you should start a new paragraph leading to Isaiah 53 with the second line of verse 15. But we will have to wait until next week in order to do that. This is lecture number 9 by Alan McCrae on Isaiah chapters 40 through 56.